I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Okay. Welcome to Nature Biotechnology's First Rounders podcast. My name is Brady Huggett. I am the host of this show. And how are you? I'm good. New York is better. After our terrible spike, we've managed to knock the virus down and keep it down. Mostly people are social distancing out there. Mostly the masks are on. I'm kind of proud. Fingers crossed. But our office is not yet open, which means I'm barred from the studio. And so this interview is done again through a video interface. It works, as I've said, it works, but, you know, New York is a loud city. It's hard to find a quiet spot. This is summer. You know, you have to shut the AC off in order to record these. So I was recording this one. It just kept getting hotter and hotter, and the sun was going down and slanting through the window and sort of blinding me in one eye, and I just thought, oh, I miss the days of me and a guest across the table and two mics. I miss doing these face-to-face. They're supposed to be face-to-face. They're better face-to-face. And I look forward. I look forward to going back to that. So who's the guest? The guest is Nubar Afeyan, the CEO and founder of Flagship Pioneering. We discussed his upbringing. He was born in Beirut and lived in Lebanon until his family fled the Lebanese Civil War. And we talked about how the mindset of an immigrant, the mindset of a refugee, how that is applicable to entrepreneurship. And we talked about what it takes. What does it take to truly innovate? Not just, hey, I'm going to start a company, but what does it take to build a company based around a brand new set of knowledge? What does it take to conceive of a company never before conceived of and then build it? And how do you do that systematically, which is what Flagship is trying to do? We talked about that. And we did, of course, talk about the pandemic. You know, Nubar is also a co-founder of Moderna, which is developing a vaccine for SARS-CoV-2. So we did discuss that a little too. So let's pick the conversation up here, where he and I are talking about the amount of speculation that scientists are being asked to do in the face of so much being unknown about COVID-19 and SARS-CoV-2. Anything else that you should know? I don't think so. So here it is, your first Rounders podcast with Nubar Afeyan. Listen up.
You know, when you're given a new reality, you know, speculating on whether a new type of vaccine is going to be safer or less safe or whatever, it's what, you know, speculate. I don't know. I never thought that science and speculation had a lot to do with each other, but I'm learning that apparently it does.
They do, yeah. So the other thing I realize is that you were born in Beirut.
I was born in Beirut. Yes.
Yeah. So are you, do you still have family there? Or are you in touch with, like, you know, what's happened?
I don't have family that's left there because I'm of Armenian origin, and Armenians have basically been kind of circling the world trying to find a place where they take for more than a generation or two. And Beirut was one such place that we had ended up in for a couple of generations. And when the Civil War hit, many, many, if not most Armenians ended up leaving. And so, you know, what little family I had there to begin with is no longer there. And so, but I have obviously friends and cultural roots there. And so it's obviously, I was there a year ago, I was there 3 years ago, but I was not there for the 40 years before that.
Well, let's I actually want to ask about that, because I think, you know, from what I was able to find is that you were fairly old when your family moved away. So you spent, you know, formative mm-hmm. years there.
I did spend formative years there. I was a teenager when I left, and it was quite difficult period towards the end of, the last 9 months or so were a civil war. So I lived through kind of a period of time where the city that I grew up in and idolized was fairly well destroyed back in 75. That was the beginning of what ended up being an eight-year civil war. We left about 6 months into the active part of it. But, you know, seeing people, dead people on the street and seeing bombs go off across the street from you and across the town, you know, over a long period of time. And, you know, of course it does affect you, because right now, you know, people are freaking out over not going to school over a pandemic. Imagine not going to school over war. So it's a completely different feeling.
So your first, 12 years or so, it was like any other normal sort of upbringing, and then everything just took a sharp turn. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I would say that the neighborhood has been, you know, kind of a rough neighborhood all along. But so there were signs of it being, but it was not unsafe. I mean, that's for sure. It was not unsafe. In 73, there was a war between Syria and Israel, which basically played out on the Mediterranean Sea right outside where we lived in Beirut. So we used to watch F-16s shutting down Russian planes in front of us. Like the old version of a video game used to be a live version of airplanes chasing each other, shooting each other down. So we saw that in 73. But then in 75, it was, you know, full out. No, it was a rough neighborhood, but it was a unusual city before, and it's been destroyed over and over again, including a few weeks ago.
All right. So you're saying that you're growing up and you're sort of like you're defining your last memories of Beirut were buildings torn down, blown up, bodies in the streets, and your family being like, we have got to get out of here.
Yes, that's right. And then, yeah, I ended up in Montreal, hadn't seen snow before. And so that's where I grew up. By the way, are you recording, or is this a preamble?
Oh, yeah. No, it's on. It's on. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm kind of curious about, you know, I've read some like features on you, and you've talked about the immigration experience and sort of linked that to entrepreneurism. Yeah. But I also want to think about sort of what that does to a child to be like, oh, everything is really precarious. Everything is very dangerous all of a sudden.
Right.
We have to flee and go someplace else. Like when you get to Canada, what is your mindset about, I don't know, life and education
and
everything else?
No, you're very astute to raise the issue. It did definitely form my personality, my mindset. You know, I've long described and in the classes I've taught at MIT and Harvard Business School, now more recently, course, you know, basically entrepreneurship courses for many years and innovation courses. And one of the things I've long said is that my sense of a entrepreneurial mindset, or even for that matter, an extreme innovation mindset, is to be a paranoid optimist. And then this duality of paranoia and optimism is an incredibly important, in my view. You can't aspire to be that, but if you have that kind of duality, it certainly does help navigate the uncertainty and the sudden changes in the environment, the dynamism of such spaces. So, I mean, you know, when I came to Montreal, you know, everything was new. And fortunately, I had a good education back in Beirut, so that knew English quite almost fluently. French knew enough to get along. Yeah, I mean, in Beirut, they taught you four languages. You know, I learned Armenian, Arabic, and French and English, and nobody bothered to ask whether that was good to feed all those languages into unsuspecting children's brains. And so people just did that. And so that ended up, little did I know how much it would help in an immigrant kind of lifestyle, because, you know, Montreal was quite francophone when we got there and became more so after we got there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but you know, one of the things it does is it just, makes you kind of perceive the world around you in a bit more of a lonely way. You don't have a country and a community and a tribe to kind of help you figure this out. So you have your family, and then you have your own, you develop your own ability to figure this out. And very little is taken for granted. And you know, I didn't realize much of that, by the way, until a few years ago when I, based on the philanthropy work I'm involved with, which involves a lot of refugee-related things, I started realizing that a lot of the mindsets that I was perceiving are mindsets that I grew up with. In fact, I didn't even realize until I went back and looked at it that when we immigrated to Canada, we immigrated basically based on a status that the Canadian government gave us of being persecuted, you know, effectively refugees, in the sense that we escaped the Civil War because our lives were threatened and Canada took us in that situation. I didn't feel that way. My parents never really kind of portrayed it that way, but in reality, that's
what it was.
That's what it was.
Yeah. Right. So, and how big was your family? So, you know, you said you didn't have a tribe, but your family was your parents, your brothers and sisters.
I have two other brothers. One of whom is a business, kind of runs his own business up in Montreal. He still lives there. And another one is a theoretical physicist and who lives in the Bay Area. And then my parents. And then we had a quite an influential person in my life, and everybody has influential people. In our case, it was my great aunt, so my grandfather's sister, who basically moved in to help my parents with three boys in Beirut back in the what would have been the late 50s when my oldest brother was born, and lived with us till she was 101 years old in Montreal.
Oh my God!
And she had gone through the, you know, World War One. You know, her family went through a lot of trauma during this Armenian genocide. Then went to France and lived in Greece for a long time, and then came to Beirut. So this woman, who was 75 when I was born, and or maybe 78, and 101 when she passed away, was a pretty influential. So that was six of us, and she was kind of probably the ancestral wisdom, if there was one, to be brought to bear, because she had gone through many, many, many immigrant experiences. And my father, who was born in, you know, my father was also a product of immigration, because he was born in Bulgaria. Communism came in when he was 20 years old. He fled with his parents, went to Turkey, went to Greece, then it settled in Lebanon, and then had to pack up everything mid life for him, basically in his 40s. And just restart again in a different country. So all of those things definitely helped, you know, provide some degree of, I'd say, mindset plus resourcefulness, because very little is going to be given.
So that everyone in your family basically had some sort of unsettling in their life. So the Civil War comes and your dad's like, well, you know, I've seen this before. We need to try again. And your great aunt is like, we got to try again. Go somewhere else.
You sound like you almost know them. That's exactly what happened. In fact, if you go to there's an interesting movie called Beirut that was made a few years ago, which captured the time, around that time, the U.S. Embassy and how it was involved in various activities at the time. And there was a lot of political games being played in different countries that were influencing each other. And suffice it to say that I remember, I mean, that's the movie had scenes in it that I almost felt like I was in, because my dad, who was from Bulgaria, and so he was not a Lebanese person himself, used to have a lot of friends in the Canadian embassy, Belgian embassy, and then the U.S. embassy, and a lot of good friends, just social friends. And in hindsight, having watched that movie and having heard since that time, I'm pretty sure that a lot of people knew what was about to happen in Beirut, because I think a lot of those people told them, pack up your bags and get out of here. And we literally left 2 months, 3 months into it. The rest of our community in Beirut were like, why are you leaving? And how can you make such a decision? And this too shall pass. And he was told pretty clearly, this is a very long battle, get out. And we literally just got. And so you said unsettled, I call this rootedness. You know, the downside is that I have become unrooted, because I was often uprooted. The good side is, if you're going to innovate, rooting is not a very useful thing, because you got to be comfortable changing the area you work in, and you keep kind of and not feeling entitled. So one of the things that you roots give you is a sense of entitlement, false or real. You don't have any entitlement if you're unrooted.
So you miss, like, not being rooted, you miss the concept of knowing where your home exactly is, or that feeling of comfort maybe. But by being unrooted, you're always prepared for change.
Yes.
It doesn't really affect you as much as it affects other people. And that's a strength in a way.
I think so. And I often think about words, and I've always been intrigued by the difference between rationale, which is the reason you do something, and rationalization, which is the reason you say why you did that thing. So I got to be always careful whether this is actually true or not. But at least, in hindsight, I think that to some extent, I probably sought out the extremes of things that I've ended up working on in terms of the innovations that I've been involved with for the last 33 years. And as a direct kind of involved in conception and invention of some of these things, because I was neither put off by the uncertainty nor seeking the expertise that accompanies kind of making innovations in a space. And so, if you don't know any better, you end up doing things in a space that feel like they're not quite the next logical thing to work on. And so I found myself over and over being willing to work on things that really were not adjacencies to what had been done before. And I do think that's in part, maybe in large part, due to this unrooted kind of way of exploring idea space. That's I think these things have definitely merged.
When you come to Montreal, was that must have been a culture shock beyond just the snow. But I mean, okay, now you're around this Canadian culture, you're surrounded by Canadian kids. What are your memories of that?
You know, on the one hand, of course, despair at having lost every single friend, every single familiar bakery and familiar soccer field, basketball court, beach that you grow up with. And then you find yourself in a city that has no access to water. I mean, it has a river, and living in an apartment building. Of course, fortunately, my dad had some means based on the business that he had in Beirut, but even though he abandoned everything and moved, we at least settled in not in a financially desperate situation. So at least, you know, I'm with my two brothers. We switched over, went to school in Montreal. It was quite ironic because, you know, little known fact, actually, I've never really talked about any of this stuff. But when I came to Canada, they ended up concluding that I should skip a grade, because what they were forcing us to learn back in Beirut were actually the equivalent of one grade ahead. And I was probably good enough in the class to be able to pick up the pieces they thought. And so literally, and that was not me. I mean, it was just the school system seemed a bit different. And so, you know, I adapted and culturally everything was different. Snow was just symbolic of the difference. It was a physical instantiation of what it feels like when you've not been in that situation before. It was a hybrid. The good thing about Montreal was that it was a cosmopolitan place, and there were cultures trying to get along between, and languages trying to get along. And there was a bit of this kind of oppressed mentality still in the French Canadians that was playing out, which was not off-putting to us because, you know, we were a minority. Armenians are a minority in Lebanon. Everybody is a minority in Lebanon. It's a place of minorities. It was interesting. Certainly, a lot of learning to do. Ended up going to a Jesuit all boys high school. Of course, that's not my background either. But it ended up, they were very education centric and a lot of kind of formalisms and kind of knowledge and education was important for them. And so then it became also for us. So yeah, it was an interesting adaptation.
Yeah, I mean, Jesuits are interesting thinkers, no?
They were very thoughtful, and they kind of, for them, values and ethics in the learning of subjects, not just kind of learning, is an important kind of horizontal kind of cut at what is otherwise vertical areas of expertise. And I always appreciated that. Of course, now the the Pope is a Jesuit, so they've kind of had their moment after all these years of themselves feeling oppressed within a. So anyway, you can always find that if you look for it.
So then you stayed in Montreal and you went to McGill, I think, for your undergrad.
I went to McGill. I studied chemical engineering, and it was an interesting choice because I actually applied to go to McGill in electrical engineering before I knew what electrical engineering was. And that's what people did who had good grades. I guess I just kind of went with the flow. This was before computer science was kind of a very active. It was just beginning to be active. And so I think I was drawn to being at some version of a cutting edge. But before I even started the school in Montreal, the system is you have 3 years of what they consider college, because there's a 2-year junior college between high school and university. So it was a 3-year program. And I had a chance over the summer to try to figure out what it is one learns in electrical engineering. And I decided that I should actually try to do something more chemistry oriented. And then eventually got drawn to the biological kind of frontier of chemical engineering, which was not even existent at the time. So in 1983, that was a completely new field. But it was, chemical engineering, like any other engineering, was just learning how to think, how to problem solve, how to integrate scientific disciplines, materials, flow of heat, flow of electricity, flow of mass, everything. And so kind of how to think about merging and melding disciplines to try to solve problems. That was a very good starting point.
Why were you drawn to the sciences? Was there anyone in your family, I don't know what your dad did or your mom, were they teachers or scientists, or was this just something natural in you that you were attracted to science?
I think it was interesting. I was, I'm sure this is the case for lots and lots of people. So my father I'd studied architecture, but by virtue of having to go to Lebanon and start all over again, he became a business person because there was no way he could practice what he had learned. My mother was a pianist, was a formally trained pianist, used to teach piano. And so science was not in my family. I had my older brother, as I mentioned at the time, was 3 years older than me, studied electrical engineering and ended up, so I'd say at the time I joined McGill, he was finishing his undergraduate studies. So that was certainly a scientific kind of journey for him. He's, as I said, later on gone into physics. But I think what was gripping to me was in high school, as is typically the case, I had a professor in physics. I used to loathe biology growing up, so I never took biology. I took chemistry because I had to, but I loved physics. And the physics professor, largely because the physics professor was just this extraordinary human being, Professor Mukherjee, in high school, and he just captivated, anybody that talked to him about the wonders of physics. This is one of these people who had immigrated from India, had become a high school teacher, and for 15 years had been doing his PhD at night, trying to get a PhD even while he was teaching physics. And in fact, quite sadly, I'll mention it, maybe one of your listeners will know this. He was just an unbelievable human being for me. And ultimately, he got his PhD, and he booked a trip to go back to, this was long after I was had graduated, but this was a sad story. He booked a trip to go back to India for the first time because he had gotten his PhD, and it was an airplane that flew from Canada to India that actually blew up, and he died as a result of an airplane accident. So it was really a devastating loss, but it was just, these things happen. But anyway, so he instilled in me. Sorry.
Well, was he on his way home to India? I finally have my PhD. Very proud. I'm going to go show my family. Yes. Oh, that's a terrible story. Yeah,
very much so. It is. Well, but this is like. But anyway, he was to me kind of just. So, but I mean, everybody gets touched by people like that. And in my case, it was Professor Mukherjee. That pushed me towards science. He actually was quite good at kind of transmitting the wonder of science. I always thought kind of people think that in artistry there is a certain degree of imagination and creativity, and somehow in science there's less of it. I never understood that. I thought science was just all about wonderment and that, and if you were willing to wonder in areas that weren't known, you used one set of techniques, and if you were wondering in other areas, then you used a different set of techniques, and that was attractive. So any science would have been of interest.
And then I know that you went to MIT for your PhD. So you left Canada. Again, you uprooted yourself and went to another country for this. But I was thinking about this too, because, you know, MIT, of course, now is really entrepreneurial. I mean, you know, when I go there, I mean, yes, I'm speaking to like startups or translational researchers. So maybe that's self-selecting, but the campus just sort of oozes this chaotic startup mindset. What was it like?
Oh, no, it was actually kind of a technical university with a chip on its shoulder, because at least in 83 when I got there, because especially in biology, because it had some phenomenal biologists, but they weren't, you know, Salvador Luria had gotten the Nobel Prize, but David Baltimore and Phil Sharp and all of these folks were not known at the time at all, or yet. I mean, Baltimore was getting known. And they wanted to compete with the best of the best. So MIT always had, to me, the ambition of being absolutely the best in every single thing it was involved with, or fail trying. And I think that's driven a lot. And it's culturally, it's not, and in fact, never believing it's the best. That's the part that I love about MIT. I'll warn you that I'm on the board of trustees there now for a few years, and so I have every. Yeah. I'm not just saying this as an observer, but I've long believed that. I definitely was attracted there because they, you know, there's other universities that I know, including in Boston, where they want to be the best and they believe they are, by definition, the best. That's a little different way of, that's a different relationship with best. And MIT always had this self-effacing way. So I was drawn to it, not because of any entrepreneurial things. In fact, I had no entrepreneurial thoughts at the time, but because I was interested in chemical engineering to work on whatever happened to be the most cutting edge part of chemical engineering. And there were two or three areas at the time. One was semiconductor processing, which was drawing chemical engineers for the first time into making kind of smaller and smaller feature controlled chemical reactions, and chemical vapor deposition was causing chemical engineers to enter the making of silicon chips. The second was the use of what eventually has been machine learning, but at the time was viewed as AI, as it related to doing control of large complex operations. So kind of the application of sophisticated algorithms and neural nets and the like in the control of chemical processes. And then the third was biotechnology, which in 1983, when I got my undergraduate degree, was just beginning to enter the broader consciousness, and engineers were not working on this. There were microbiologists who were kind of applied microbiologists who were kind of getting involved in making bacterial fermentations happen, but that was about it. And and I ended up coming to MIT because it had all three of those variants of chemical engineering, because it was one of the premier departments. And
yeah, so I think you got your PhD in biochemical engineering, yeah. And then, but yes. you're still pretty young, 24 or something like that.
24, yes.
And then, but tell me where I'm wrong, but I think from that point you founded Perceptive.
Yes. So the story there is again, you know, some of these things where you kind of get lucky in human interaction. So for me, the kind of my change of arc towards an entrepreneurial kind of journey, which has been what I've done since, basically, was in 1985. Before then, you know, I was probably equally restless, equally curious, but somewhat trying to get better and better at what I was doing, but not with a view that the choices were you worked as an you got into academia, or you went and worked for Merck or DuPont or, you know, one of the large companies, because that's what well-trained, pedigreed engineering PhDs did. But in 1985, I had a chance encounter. I was at an NSF meeting in Washington, D.C., where I don't know why MIT had sent me. I guess there was not that many people in biotechnology at the time. And this was a conference on competitiveness. And this was the time when the U.S. was worried that Japan was going to clean its clock when it came to technological innovation. And there was all these alarmed meetings taking place. And I ended up being sent by my professor to go to this meeting, where there was going to be all sorts of discussions about the frontiers in bio and other kinds of fields. And at this event, at a lunch, I happened to sit next to somebody, and I got enough courage to ask him what he did. And he started telling me how he and another friend of his had years and years ago been trained as a new breed of engineer, at the time called electronic engineers, and that there was a shift in the power engineering departments to electronic engineers, and that then led to electrical engineers, and how he and this friend of his had graduated, because I was a PhD, so I was asking him kind of how he ended up doing what he's doing, graduated and decided that all these new breed of engineers are going to have to make devices, at the time, analog circuitry, and they thought of making instruments that their friends could use to design the things. They didn't know what they were going to design, but the circuitry that they were going to work on. And so they made oscilloscopes in their garage and then grew a company out of that. And I found that, you know, linearly I was thinking, well, I'm studying to be a new breed of engineer, and you know, I don't know what people are going to make with this new breed of engineering, but I know they're going to need instruments and tools. And I was thinking of all the tools that I ended up using, you know, in my lab work to purify proteins, analyze proteins, you know, synthesize things. And I was kind of mapping it, saying, well, it's kind of interesting. It's a similar moment in time, you know, this many decades later. And so then I asked him who he was. I had no idea who he was. And it was David Packard from Hewlett-Packard. And so I had no idea who he was, never heard his name before. I heard of Hewlett-Packard. I didn't think Hewlett-Packard was making oscilloscopes, which they were not at the time. But, you know, he then spent another hour talking to me about it. He said, look, you know, I said, well, what do I have to learn? And he said, well, this is stuff that you can't really learn, but if you really should learn how to manage innovation and how to manage people and how to think about value and things that they don't teach you in engineering school. So in fact, I came back to MIT and I went to the Sloan School, which was the business school at MIT, and tried to, you know, kind of talk my way into taking courses. At the time, they had huge barriers to any engineering or science students taking business courses, both from the business side and from the engineering side, because they thought there was an incompatibility in language and in focus, and you know, it would drag people down. So I ended up taking a few courses, three of them, as a PhD student, which was unusual at the time. And that's how and then I literally started thinking, you know, pretty specifically about how to innovate to make new tools for this new breed of engineers.
So you were like, well, there's kind of two career paths for me. One is joining DuPont or Merck. One is staying in academia. And the first time someone else said, well, there's a third way, you're like, that's the way I'm going to do it.
Yes. And it was intriguing to me because I think it spoke to my kind of probably risk tolerance, although I probably didn't know the word risk or tolerance back then, but also just personality. I kind of figured, you know, and it was in hindsight, it was a look, 30 years later, 33 years later, it's definitely it's what people do. But back then, people didn't do that at all, let alone young people, let alone immigrants, because I then quickly met entrepreneurs, and they were all white, middle-aged men who had worked in big jobs before, and once they had made enough money, had kind of been tapped on the shoulder by venture capitalists to come in and start a company in an area. And I was none of those. Well, I was male, but I was none of the rest. And so, yeah.
But to do that as a middle-aged man who's sort of already had a career isn't all that risky, though, right? You've already had your career at some point, and you've already got enough money in the bank, and now someone has tapped you, as you said, to start a company. That isn't all that risky versus I'm going to do this right out of school. I'm only 25 years old. You know, that is a risk.
Well, it's true, although I had convinced myself that the converse would be a bigger risk because you actually have a reputation you can squander, and you have a family and a kind of trajectory that is really being exposed, whereas I thought I had little to lose. I've often found when you're taking leaps of faith, I don't mean leaps of faith in the Jesuit sense of the word, but literally leaps of faith in the expression, you actually, you know, to some extent, lack of clairvoyance is helpful, because if you really know what the act of leaping is and what might happen when you land, etc., you may never make the leap. And I think that youth has a lot going for it in that respect.
Yeah.
So I do think that I probably was willing to take a bigger leap than what otherwise would have been logical.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
How did you start the company? How did you hire your team? Did you need funding to start it? I mean, obviously with these tools, the runway to profit isn't as long as if you're trying to develop a therapeutic, I suppose, but still.
Well, look, I mean, I ended up, you know, it's all about people, obviously. So after the intervening 85 to 87 period, I kind of spent some amount of time trying to think about all the technologies that I was using, which one did I feel even competent in doing anything about. And I kind of had dreamt up this technology even while I was a graduate student, which was called continuous affinity recycle extraction. Nobody knows about it because it's fairly arcane. And CARE is what it stood for. And it was a way to do affinity purification of proteins in a more industrial way. So it was a continuous system instead of a column. And I could show that you could have much higher throughput of proteins if you're going to purify proteins this way. And so, of course, I took that. That was not what the object of my PhD thesis was. That was a technique that I had developed to be able to purify proteins that I was studying. But then I thought, well, maybe I could take that and build a process technology around that. And that was the original concept that I wrote a business plan on and tried to kind of get people at the business school to look at, as well as a couple of my professors at MIT. I was working with a professor named Danny Wong, who had been involved in the forming of Biogen. And so I talked to him about it. Charlie Cooney is another professor at MIT. Who was involved in the formation of Genzyme, and he was a consultant to Genentech, so talk to him about it. Some normal ways that initially you do these things. In fact, Bob Langer was not Bob Langer back then. Bob Langer is a good colleague and friend now, but he was a fairly young professor at the time. He was not starting companies, but I knew him because he was involved. He was one of the few people who was doing bio and engineering, and he was a bit of a role model. And so the way it got started is that I actually, At a conference I went to, met a professor, another professor at Purdue University. His name is Fred Rainier. And he was a phenomenal, inventive, analytical chemist working in the field of chromatography. And so I shared some of my ideas with him. He shared some ideas he had about how to design the particles that one uses to do chromatography, not the process itself. So the two of us kind of started chatting it up. And just, you know, me as a graduate student, but with interest in potentially pursuing a startup of some sort. And then there was a third person, Bob Dean, who was a kind of experienced entrepreneur, a mechanical engineer in his case, who had started a number of companies outside of bio and had most recently started a company in the cell culture field, where he was making resins on which cells were growing, etc. And basically, my professor introduced me to Bob Dean And basically the three of us kind of got together, and Bob wanted to find a new project to work on. And he was kind of at the tail end of his career entrepreneurially. He'd been doing it for 35 years already. Fred was an academic at Purdue University who wasn't going to leave, but was interested in. So, I pulled the two of them together into what was basically a paper company. It used to be called Synosys, stood for Synthesis of Systems. Don't tell me why, purification systems. It was kind of sounded like a disease. People told me later to change the name because it sounded like a disease, so we changed it to Perceptive. And within the context of the company, started kind of thinking about what could be true innovations that beyond the initial starting point might represent breakthroughs. And we actually did work on a whole new design of particles that then became called perfusion chromatography. That was our beginning kind of trajectory. So that's how we got started.
And I mean, you ran the company for 10 years.
Ran the company for 10 years in the very beginning, hired a couple of people to provide kind of a leadership just so I would learn how to do this as well. I was chairman the whole time, and then I stepped in again as CEO. But it was over a 10-year period. I should tell you that the beginnings, I don't know why I probably attract these types of moments, but started right when the stock market crashed. So October of 1987, there's a famous Black Monday when NASDAQ crashed.
Yeah.
You know, it was the first time since the Depression that NASDAQ had crashed or Dow had crashed. It was an interesting time to get started because the whole financial world was devastated. And I was completely oblivious. I had no idea why the Dow Industrials or the NASDAQ index would have anything to do with the startup. But you realize then just how interconnected risk capital is to sentiment.
I mean, and I think it sold for, it's a PerkinElmer for $360 million or something like that, right? Which is a
at
nice...
At the time, yes. Which was
yeah,
a lot of
yeah.
money at the time, yes.
Yep. And you had a handful of other startups at the same time? Chemgenics,
well, so in,
Antigenics.
Yeah. So there was in the mid-90s, by the time Perceptive started functioning as a bit more of a professionally run company, it was already now maybe 200-300 people. At the end, we were about 850 people, but it was growing, and we had just begun to get into the mass spectrometry field. So I started kind of getting interested in figuring out ways to make some of the technologies. We had a phenomenal R&D group. We had just, we had 80, 90 PhDs, a large R&D organization. It was unusual for an instrument company, let alone any biotech company at the time. There were not very many biotech companies. And so we were doing inventions in chromatography, a capillary electrophoresis, which was new, mass spectrometry, DNA synthesis, peptide synthesis. I mean, we had a huge number of activities, all aimed at better and better tools. And then I realized as a public company, the company that took the company public in 1992, that in our shareholders couldn't care less about these things. They just wanted the core business to grow and to be profitable. And I was taking all the money and putting it back into doing better and better products. And so what ended up happening is I started realizing that there was maybe a possibility of taking some of these technologies and spinning them out. And so that is what Chemgenics was. Then at the time, there were a couple of companies being started that were technologically related to one of the many things Perceptive did. So I got involved as a co-founder in a couple of companies, one in diagnostics, one in vaccines. And then I kind of found myself, even though I was still CEO and trying to grow Perceptive, but I found myself interested more and more in what I came to view as parallel entrepreneurship instead of serial entrepreneurship, because I didn't want to leave my job to do another company. But I also was drawn to the value creation you could make by going from nothing to something, as opposed to something to three times that something.
Yeah, when I look at the history, your history, what's kind of shocking is how quickly you hit the ground running like that. Right out of your PhD, started a company, and even while that company's growing, you're spinning things out.
Like I said, you learn long ago, ignorance is bliss. So then I'm not being self-effacing. I really don't. There are many, many, many things I did 25 years ago that I would not do now, nor tell my kids to do. because I have kids that are now the same age as I was when I started. Not to say that I would make them any less or discourage them from taking risks, but those kinds of risks do in hindsight seem extreme. And yeah. I think it was largely not necessarily being as focused on being thoughtful and planful. I mean, look, we haven't talked about it, but I'll tell you what has over time kind of also emerged in my and I'm trying to understand all this is just the degree to which I was being drawn to the power of Darwinian evolution as a thought process. And in fact, when I started Flagship, that was the central mechanism I planned to use to be able to scale and systematize innovation in itself, which is just very much this notion that if you take a multi-component object, could be thought, could be a watch, it could be a computer, it could be anything, but a multi-component object, and create variation and apply selection in an iterative fashion, you get novelty, you get extreme novelty in ways that our brains can't really comprehend because of the combinatorial nature of the components that when recombined could create massive diversity. Those things that you might why does one apply that to this? If I had studied evolution as a graduate student or undergraduate student, I probably wouldn't have thought of this. But because I didn't, and because I had to go and try to figure out what is all this about, it's really been a one of the main driving forces in my belief of where an alternative place where innovation could come from. I think much of novelty, whether it's in consumer goods and songs and human endeavor, is nothing more than that.
Well, let me ask, so in that analogy, and I look at the Flagship portfolio, are the watches each portfolio company?
Each
or
platform.
Or the watches inside?
Both of them.
Each
it's
platform.
Recursive. But the platforms that we invent are very much, as I'm sure you've seen, but these are very much not things that are iterations of what exists, but rather are projections of what could exist that then in an iterative way are descendants are discovered that become more and more and more reasonable seeming. And that's the starting point for what we work on, not an experiment that shows some incremental improvement and then we try to go start a company around it. So I'm connecting it to kind of like that you said, you did this early on and did this quickly. If you think you have to be sure of something before you do it, it takes you a long time to do it because you're unsure of so much. If you feel like you'll figure it out, and you emergence maybe is the word to think about it. I think emergence is a powerful human activity if only people would surrender to accepting the risks of it versus feeling like, well, wait a minute, is the next step going to work? And how do I know it's going to work? And let me ask a lot of people to give me advice as to whether it's going to work or not. And by that time, somebody else who doesn't have to wait for that is way advanced.
But when you look at Perceptive and then the four companies that came out of there, Antigenics, Chemgenics, you had two go public and two that were bought, I think. So that's kind of five companies that all would have achieved an exit of some sort. And Perceptive went public before that. So when you look back, was that sort of like a false sense of this is really easy?
I don't think that I thought it was easy along the way, I must say. And I just want to make sure I correct you. These did not all come out of Perceptive. The technologies were related to Perceptive, and one of them came out of Perceptive. But they were all in the neighborhood of Perceptive, for damn sure.
You were in Perceptive,
while I was
still.
In Perceptive. Yeah, so I was in Perceptive, my contributions were. But in one case, it was literally a spin-out of Perceptive. But, easy is probably not the word, because I don't think I thought any of it was easy. But look, the 90s were fundamentally an easier time to create or to get rewarded for innovation in this space, because everything we worked on was the first time, right? So, when you did chemical genomics, there was no chemical genomics happening. When you did personalized cancer vaccines, there was nobody doing personalized. When you did stool-based diagnostics, there was nobody doing that. So every single thing there was no precedent, because everything that came before was recombinant proteins and then antibodies. So it was just the kind of, like in natural evolution, actually, there are periods of diversification, and then there's periods of long periods of kind of conserved things until something kind of explodes again. So I would say in the 90s, both the financial markets and the sheer novelty of it was such that, in at least in my experience, and I think in others, it was relatively easier to have an impact. Conversely, between 2000 and 2010, it was unusually hard to have an impact because people basically went from, you know, glass half full to glass mostly empty. Didn't matter how much liquid you had in it. And you had to continually, or glass with a hole in it, but you had to continually fill it for people to believe anything you were saying. And then it's kind of equilibrated since.
So now this makes like perfect sense to me. So this concept of, you said paranoid optimism, mm-hmm. right? Which with every company that you're working on, you're thinking it's something's probably going to go wrong. That's the paranoia, but we'll figure it out. That's the optimism. And you apply that to every company.
Well, yeah, that's at least a balancing force of the tendencies to become either overly paranoid that nothing's going to work, in which case you don't even try, or to overly optimistic, which means that, you know, you'll figure everything out without this fear factor. And so the fear factor is respecting uncertainty and recognizing the fact that the underlying conditions are constantly changing. And so you just have to kind of adapt and respond. And no business plan, no strategy, no forethought can actually eliminate that, except if you go 1 foot away from where you are intellectually. So one of the things I'll tell you is that I think, you know, some other time I'm happy to talk more about this, but I think that much of innovation is heavily limited by reasonableness. I think we live in a scientific fields are this way. Most of what humans do is all about how reasonable is what you're saying. And my one of the other challenges that I kind of think a lot about is, why do people expect extraordinary results from reasonable people doing reasonable things? In which world should there be extraordinary outcomes? And yet everybody's looking for extraordinary outcomes, but they constantly want to figure out whether every single step is the right reasonable step. People go ask key opinion leaders, they do what's called due diligence, and there's this massive crowdsourced reasonableness filter, and yet they expect extraordinary results. And I learned a long time ago that if you're aspiring to extraordinary results, you have got to be comfortable being unreasonable and persistently so. So you might say, well, then if you're just not reasonable, does that mean you get extraordinary results? And of course, not the case. It's not reversible. So that's where the evolutionary approach comes in, because you first project yourself to things that to places where people consider completely unreasonable in terms of what you're proposing to do or how you're proposing to do it. But then what makes you survive is recognizing that when you get there, you can do variation and selection looking for what survives. And that then ends up being the thing that we create companies around. Every single one of the companies we've created has the exact same genesis.
I mean, I just love that connection to your family line where, again and again, we've got to leave this country. We've got to leave this country. Now this government is falling apart. That's the paranoia. And then, but we'll figure it out. That's the optimism. Of course, you don't know that you'll figure it out. Maybe that's just something you tell the children so that they're not terrified. You don't know that it's going to be okay in the end. But yeah, those two things work in tandem to build companies. Yeah, it's fascinating.
Well, I mean, look, you meant by definition, survivors write the story, and therefore for them, they have survived.
It does work out, right?
And it has worked out. Doesn't mean it will continue to work out. And presumably some of the factors that go into that survivalist mindset at least might, not in every single case, but might increase the odds of further survival. One of the other things, though, just for your audience to keep in mind, is another thing I've learned, though, to this layers of layers of these, is that survival, while it is one of the most, you know, kind of striking features of startups and of innovation, and of, for that matter, any kind of competitive activity or difficulty, survival is necessary but not sufficient to thriving. And that's another mistake people make, is that if you keep surviving, you will thrive. And of course, in the startup world, that's not true. If you keep surviving, you will have survived. And that gives you the opportunity to thrive. But one of the things we spend a lot of time with at Flagship trying to understand is, what are the things that lead to thriving, whether it's the nature of what you're working on or the people who are working on it, or the, and then what decisions tie thriving and surviving, usually in the opposite direction. In other words, you do something that increases your odds of thriving, but at the risk of surviving, and vice versa. You do things that you use to survive, and it takes away 95% of your upside. And so how do you separate those things, and how do you ensure that you're doing both, surviving and thriving, separate activities?
And you said this thing earlier. This goes back to your launching Perceptive in 84 or whatever,
87, when
Black Monday happened. And you didn't really realize that if the markets close down, then that dries up venture capital and the exit's gone or whatever. And when not only the US, but the sort of world began to go into lockdown for this virus, you know, my first thought was, well, okay, there go the markets and there go the exits, and we may see venture money start to dry up. Now, that has not been the case yet, I know we're only 6 months in, but I found that surprising. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that if this was a pandemic of automation or something, let's say cars all of a sudden were unsafe, or clothes were all of a sudden disintegrating, I'm just making it up, then I don't think biotechnology would be a beneficiary. But the reality is, it so happens that it is our lives, which is a biological concept, that are threatened by a communicable disease, which is a biological concept, which we can counteract with biological as well as behavioral modifications. And so, you know, it just so happens that the very science that we're exploring and deploying towards health solutions, whether they're diagnostics or therapeutics, happens to be the center of attention of this pandemic. So I never thought that venture capital in this field or risk capital would diminish. And we fairly early on thought that there would be if depending on how it works out, there may be increasing attention. I never thought that every TV station, even ESPN, would be talking about whether antibodies last a long time and whether the diagnostic testing had a positive predictive value of X. So, you know, or Vogue, you know, all these magazines have had some aspect to the story. That is an extent that is unforeseeable. But that biology, life science would come of age during this period, I have no doubt, and it's happening. And it'll have long-term consequences, depending on how society deals with it. One of the things that I've recently written about and I'm working pretty heavily on is that I think what should come out of this is a fundamental rethink of what healthcare is. And I, in a nutshell, I'll tell you kind of the beginning thoughts of that is that I would contend that healthcare is a euphemism, complete euphemism. It should really be called sick care. And the reason you know that is because you got to be good and sick to get any of it. We spend 97% of our healthcare dollars on things that are to detect and treat disease, not up anything upstream of that. And yet we deal with our physical security with an incredible degree of caution, and we demand to be safe from our government, and they can violate our privacy all they want to deliver us security and our health. Not that way at all. We basically assume we're going to get sick and die, and so we wait till we get diagnosed with something, and then we want gobs of money spent trying to now secure our health, which largely is too late.
I came across something that you said in the, it was like a Q&A that you did within the, I think, Armenian Mirror Spectator. And I thought you said something really interesting. You said that, you know, we deal with the flu, the annual flu, as just a way of life. Here comes the flu, are you going to get your vaccine? And every year the flu will actually, you know, it'll kill some immune compromised people. It'll kill some of the elderly, of course, but that's just sort of the way that we operate. But for some reason we're treating this pandemic as a, I think you call it a terrorist attack. And you're like, why the difference?
Yeah. And I think it's because we're beginning to realize that we've been super fatalistic about it. And now that it actually reached a shortness of the time it took for the people to start dying and the reach got exposed, Yeah, but actually the underlying things that allowed the flu to exist is what's allowing this to exist, the spread. And so I'd hate for us to go back to accepting the flu as though that's okay, that amount of the street crime's okay, but terrorism, that's a real offense. I think we should get rid of basically all crime. And I think we can in this analogy when it comes to thinking about security. And health security is not wellness. Wellness to me precedes health security. Health security is when we are being protected against, predictable outcomes of our genetics, our age, our lifestyle, that we then have to watch it intensely for. And so, I tell people what I envision is turning on the television. There won't be any television 20 years from now, but 20 years from now, and seeing an ad that is embellishing the beauty of a pre-patient journey, not a patient journey. Today, you turn on television and you feel like you're a superstar because you're watching somebody who's got psoriasis or who's got cancer, and they glorify it like, oh my God, this patient journey is such a wonderful thing. I, for one, would rather be stuck on a pre-patient journey, and I'd rather not go on one of these glorious cruise ships that take you on a patient journey. And yet, that seems like an illogical statement in 2020. That I hope will change.
Yeah, I mean, do you think that we are? I was just talking to this about this with somebody. We weren't accustomed to wearing masks, and of course now we're very accustomed to wearing masks. And he was saying that he can't imagine flying again without wearing a mask, because every time he flies, especially if it's international, you come back with a cold. He's like, why won't I wear a mask? Yeah. Absolutely. And that's kind of like what you're saying. It's a little more preventative as opposed to just waiting until you get the thing and then dealing with it.
Yeah. And I'd like the government to spend some money trying to survey for these things and detect these things and be prepared with repertoires of vaccines or antibodies or two predictable things. I mean, you can predict what types of changes will lead to the spread of some of these diseases. And why don't we just spend some money? And another extreme example is nuclear stockpiles. We spent billions of dollars coming up with weapons that we expect never to use as a deterrence, right? How much money do we spend stockpiling anything that has anything to do with a pandemic? The answer is approximately zero. And
right.
So it's just the difference is unbelievable. We're fatalistic towards our health, but we are incredibly insistent of being given physical security. Therein lies, in my view, something that needs to be reconsidered.
Yep, that makes sense. I want to ask this too. So, before when the year started, the general opinion of the biopharma industry was really low, and this is basically centered around pricing, pricing of drugs. And if for sure that was going to be a big topic in the presidential election here in the U.S. And I'm wondering if you think that perception has begun to change a little bit because there's such a focus on the biopharma industry for vaccines and therapies against the pandemic, against COVID.
I think it's changed somewhat, but I don't know how long term that change will be, because at the end of the day, the pharma industry, more so than the biotech industry, is generally, still selling a majority of drugs that don't work on most of the people that take them. And they work on some, and the newer drugs are more specific, but the reality is that, how I keep hearing how vaccines have to be cheap because you're giving them to a lot of people who don't need them. Well, drugs also are being given to a lot of people who don't benefit from them, but they're still being charged as though they are getting the benefit. And so I think that's an unsustainable model. I think value has to come into the equation with pharmaceutical pricing. So I think those issues aren't going to go away, but you're right. There's a bit of a reprieve because right now, every pharmaceutical company has entered this, kind of this so-called race, which is an awful description of what we're engaged with.
Yeah.
I think there'll be a period of time. And plus these big companies are spending enormous amounts of money on communications just for that reason. So I don't think too many politicians are going to be going out and speaking against, the savior kind of aspect of this industry right now. Now, will that last very long time? How long will people remember this? I don't know.
One final thing I want to ask you. So you've been running Flagship for about 20 years, I guess. Yeah, 20 years. And there are, 40 companies that have been spun out of there? At least 40.
Oh, no, there's probably 90 now. There's 40 that are current, that are probably current, but there's, yeah, there's probably over time,
90.
Probably about 90, yeah.
So what do you think the next 20 years will look like? I mean, given that the industry is going to continue to change the way that it has in the past 20 years, will you still be able to spin them out at that rate? We saw the success at that rate.
Well, I don't know about success, because I mean, I think that's just the way you measure it. But if success is the ability to conceive of platforms that are disconnected with current reality, offer some pretty significant potential to change, to impact with new solutions, health or sustainability, which is another area that we work in, then I don't see why that's a finite space. I don't think that's, you know, that's, let's put it this way. If, you know, I would draw everything that we know and that we do in a circle, and then I would draw a concentric ring around that, which represents the adjacencies. Mm-hmm. And I would say that most current innovation goes after the adjacencies of what already exists, the first circle.
Yeah.
Outside of that is the realm of the possible, which to everybody inside the first circle or the concentric circle is utterly unreasonable. And in fact, that is the case, because if you look backwards, the circle that preceded the current circle was much smaller, and it was within the first circle. So I kind of view just circle being a random geometry, but I view kind of this ever-expanding frontier of scientific knowledge or application or technology as this gradualistic act where resources go into expanding the boundary at a finite rate, driven by the rate of success you have in spending the resource to make progress, coupled with people's expectation that what you're proposing was reasonable. That's kind of the diffusion of the boundary. Nothing takes into account what happens if you can escape that and kind of come backwards and say, what can I do outside of this that relates to what problems we perceive today? And I would argue that that is not a bounded space. That is not a bounded space. Now, you know, can you do with as many? So flagship is just an institutional model, an institutional system that is experimental 20 years into its existence. I'm not sure there are people that are doing what we're doing in the sense of the sheer inventions that lead to companies, that lead to products, as opposed to finding bits and pieces of science and then building, commercializing those. But I sure hope that flagship will be doing this 20 years from now, and that there'll be many, many other people adapting, improving, and doing even bigger things.
In this analogy, each company is a new circle.
In this analogy, each company, I'm not thinking of it that way. My circle is the sum total of what's known about any given space or what exists. So
right.
There's a circle for cancer, there's a circle for breast cancer, there's a circle for you know, diseases of neoplastic, you know, kind of origin. So there's different. So my point though is that generally, if you define the here and now with you bound it, then draw. Now you're right. Each new company creates its own little circle that over time itself is going to grow, and eventually some of these will merge. Because if we're right, like in the case of Moderna, when we started working on RNA for a patient-generated therapeutic, nobody was suggesting or working or any of that. There are people who had worked on RNA modifications before. There are people who were working on, you know, siRNA and lots of other things, but not that. But over time, that circle has gotten both credible enough and big enough that the current frontier now encompasses that, so that every pharmaceutical company is now working on mRNA, and a lot of academics who initially used to say, this is never going to be a therapeutic, and they still, a lot of them still do, now are beginning to kind of hope that it might be. Who knows if it will be or not? That's still the jury's out. So yes, there are these different circles of reality that merge and coalesce and fuse together.
Perfect. Thank you for taking the time. I really, really enjoyed the talk.
Well, you're interesting. You're an interesting person to talk to. It was a lot of fun. Thanks for doing a lot of work ahead of time.
Okay, there it is. Your First Rounders podcast with Noubar Fahan. Do you like how I left the compliment in at the end? I didn't know what else to do. I couldn't just have me say thank you and drop it right there without his response. So yeah, I left it in. Thank you, Noubar, for taking the time and getting on a video screen with me. That was a really, really interesting talk. I could have done that for another hour. Thank you to Midwest Quiet for use of your music in this podcast. Thank you to listeners. What else can I say? It's September 1st. You're listening to this in September. I mean, this year is both dragging on and flying by. I mean, maybe that's just the way time always goes. That's how life goes, I suppose. Okay, I will talk to you on the next one. Thank you and goodbye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.